Thank you to Mr. and Mrs. Beatty. First time I've had the opportunity to say that. Welcome back, by the way. Good to have you with us, everybody. Happy Sabbath and good afternoon to you. Hope everybody's doing well. We've had a busy week, of course, as most of us do, one way or the other, whether we're working at home or working at work or just trying to keep up with everything that's going on in life. And so we come to Sabbath services looking for peace and rest and quiet and communion and fellowship with one another and with God. And it's a wonderful thing that God has provided for us once a week to have a Sabbath day. The last time I spoke with you, I spoke about two of the biblical characters, two of the disciples, and Matthew the tax collector and Simon the zealot. And we learned some lessons from the two of them and their backgrounds about how we can learn to live in harmony with our fellow Christians, or at least I hope we did. We tried to, and I hope that that was productive and beneficial to you. I've chosen another character today among the disciples to speak with you about, and he's probably, without a doubt, the most notorious and universally scorned of all the disciples. It would be Judas Iscariot. Judas Iscariot. Now you might be thinking, why would he speak on Judas Iscariot and what can we learn from him? Well, I hope that we'll find out that there are some things to learn from Judas's experience and his life. I chose him because he's a character that I don't think we look at very often. I can't remember hearing very many, if any, messages regarding Judas in the past, and so I decided to do that today. If you'll join me in Luke 6, the sixth chapter, verses 12 through 16, we find the listing of the disciples, the calling of the disciples in Luke's account. He says, "Now it came to pass in those days that he went out to the mountain to pray and continued all night in prayer to God. And when it was day, he called his disciples to him." He called those disciples, and there were more than 12 of these, you know, and as you'll deduce as we read the rest of this section. But of the followers that he had, we don't know how many they were. Could have been upwards of 100 or more, perhaps, but nevertheless, it was more than just the 12. But it says here, then, in this latter part of verse 13, "And from them he chose 12, whom he also named apostles." Verse 14, "Simon, whom he also named Peter, and Andrew his brother, James and John, Philip and Bartholomew, Matthew and Thomas, James the son of Alphaeus, and Simon called the Zealot, Judas the son of James, and Judas Iscariot, who also became a traitor." In all of the lists of the disciples, when the 12 are listed, Judas is always listed last. And I think nobody would probably argue with that being a good place to have Judas. But there are of the other 11 disciples, there are great encouragement to be gained from studies of their lives and how they lived and so forth. And they exemplified how common people with typical shortcomings, that's like you and me, our typical shortcomings, how we can be used by God in uncommon and remarkable ways. Judas, on the other hand, stands as a warning about the evil potential of spiritual carelessness, squandered opportunities, sinful lusts, and hardness of the heart. Here was a man who drew as close as one humanly could do to the Messiah, to Jesus, and he was with him. He enjoyed every privilege of that inner circle of the 12, and he was intimately familiar with everything Jesus taught. He was there at each of those sessions when Jesus gave parables or taught other lessons or gave sermons, and yet he remained in unbelief. So today I want to talk with you about the life of the traitor, Judas Iscariot, and the moral lessons that we can learn from his life. We're going to be talking about and looking at his name, his calling, his disillusionment, his greed, his hypocrisy, and his death. And then quick lessons summarize what we learned from them. But to begin with, Judas was as common as any of the other 11 who were chosen. They were just common men without earthly credentials and without any characteristics or things that made them stand out from the group and want to be a part of Christ's group, inner group. But he began exactly as the others had begun, and it seems that he never laid hold of the truth of faith in Jesus and the plan of God as it was being carried out, even in his presence. Unlike the many of the other apostles, the New Testament tells us a lot about Judas. And we found last time that while there's very little that comes directly from the scriptures, directly attributed to Matthew and to Simon, we were able to explore the backgrounds of the hints that they have and their surnames, and being a tax collector and being a zealot, to learn how they would be at opposite ends and natural enemies with one another outside of the body of Christ. And so we're not left with as much to imagine and to deduce and to draw from historical examples and records as we are with Judas. There's enough information in the scriptures to first of all tell us about the life of Judas, that it reminds us that it is possible to be near Christ and to associate with him closely, but superficially, and yet become utterly hardened in sin. And secondly, Judas reminds us that no matter how sinful a person may be, no matter what treachery he or she may employ against God, God's purpose will always be fulfilled. It will not be thwarted. Even the worst act of treachery that works towards the fulfillment of the divine plan of God, he uses things that happen normally, naturally, to fulfill his will. So even though God's sovereign plan cannot be overthrown, even by the most cunning of schemes of men or angelic beings. And certainly that there was a point that Satan must have thought that he had won the prize when we come to the end of this story that we're going to be reading about today, or not reading. Well, I'll be reading some. You'll be listening. But you'll be reading along in the scriptures, I hope. First of all, let's look at Judas' name. Judas was a very popular name. We noticed in the list of disciples that we just read that there were two disciples named Judas, and even one of Jesus' half-brothers was named Judas. So it was a very common name. Matthew 13:55 tells us that about Jesus' brothers. And as I said, there were two disciples by that name. The name Judas is a form of Judah, and it means great. It means Jehovah leads. Jehovah leads, which indicates that when he was born, Judas's parents had the great hopes and desires and expectations for him that he would indeed be led by God to do something good in his life. That's what we all expect out of our children. And when we have them and they're small and we begin to wonder what they'll become and how they'll develop and what we can do to help them and not hurt them along the way and not cause them to be difficult to accept God's ways, but to look forward to the way of life that God leads us to, as well as education and that sort of thing. So they had great hope, no doubt, for Judas. And I've mentioned to you before that my name is Paul Allen, and Paul means small, and Allen means joy, and I was a little bundle of joy when I was born to my parents. My dad said as I got older in my late teens that I brought little joy into his life. So names do have meanings, and sometimes they change with nuances through the years. At any rate, they had great hope for him. Jehovah leads, the name Judah. And it's ironic that his name is that no one in anybody was ever more clearly led by Satan than Judas, rather than being led by God. His surname, Iscariot, signifies the geographical region that he came from. And it is derived from the Hebrew term Ish, which means man, and the name of a town about 50 miles south of Jerusalem called Kirith. So Kira, that small town, is known located in the regional area called Idumea. We don't talk about that very often. Don't see that too much in the scriptures, but that's where the Herods came from, the half Jews that lived down there and from descendants of Edom. So here we have a man from Kerioth who came to be a part of Jesus' inner circle. And he is apparently the only disciple that was not from Galilee. I don't know if we ever thought about that before, but all the other disciples, many were brothers or cousins, were familiar with friends or co-workers and so forth, and they came from that area of Galilee, but not Judas. He came from afar and came from apart. Maybe well why he was able to snow so many people and fool them. And they didn't know him beforehand, and it was only the experiences that they shared. And as we'll see, he was very, very good when it came to hypocrisy and deceit. So when Judas joined up with the other brothers and friends and co-workers and so forth that Jesus had called from Galilee, he was a solitary figure who entered their midst from afar. They didn't know much about him. We're not told anything more about his calling, how he came there. We can speculate because some of the commentators think that he and his father perhaps were zealot sympathizers. And when they heard of Jesus, they too began to expect that the kingdom might be coming soon. And he traveled up to Jerusalem and from there then on into Galilee to learn more about this Jesus that he was hearing so much about. So when his calling came about, I said that while he's named in the various lists of the 12, his calling itself is not recorded in the scriptures. We read last week how Jesus came by Matthew collecting taxes on the road to Capernaum and called him and said, "Leave that behind and come with me, come and follow me," and he did. And several of the other disciples we have information about as well. But Judas is just a blank page when it comes to how he came to be a part of the disciples. But he apparently had learned of Jesus and traveled to Galilee to hear him. And it's obvious that he voluntarily followed Jesus as one of the 12. Even though he was chosen, he volunteered and followed along. But it also seems that he followed not out of spiritual motivation as the others did. The others were so excited when they came upon Jesus and discovered and believed that he was Messiah that they had to share it with other people and did that with their friends and associates to pass the word and the joy and the excitement of a Messiah that was coming. Of course, they too were looking for primarily a political leader and deliverer, someone who had set up a political kingdom in Jerusalem. But nevertheless, they came along and began to understand more of what Jesus had to say and what his purpose was in that particular coming. But out on his own, Judas seems to be more of a person who is out on his own and out for his own ambition and power and wealth and prestige that he thought might come if he was a part of this messianic group. That he could then infiltrate because he was already a part of the inner circle, but that as the kingdom expanded then and Jesus set it up and defeated the Romans and so forth, that he would be a partaker of that. And so he seems to be far more motivated by that. And to a degree, and I can't say how much, but I think he was a pawn in a much larger game than he realized. Because Satan was trying to thwart God's plan for man's salvation through Jesus Christ by stopping the plan of God from going forward and using this man to do that. And I don't think that he was coerced, but nevertheless, things just fell into the right place, or maybe we should say the wrong place at the wrong time for him. There are prophecies that talk about Judas here that are attributed to him. In Psalms 41, verse 9, there are a number of, as I'm sure you know, messianic psalms and prophecies. But in Psalm 41, 9, it says, "Even my own familiar friend in whom I trusted, who ate my bread has lifted up his heel against me. And that's referred to in the New Testament as well and applied to Judas and his own familiar friend. In one of the accounts, when Jesus is accosted and arrested in the Garden of Gethsemane, I believe it's Matthew's account, but one of the accounts says that Jesus spoke to Judas and said, "Friend, do you betray me with a kiss?" So he was considered by Jesus a friend. And as I said, he was nothing less than any of the other disciples. He was as close other than within the group. Of course, there were smaller groups that were closer to Jesus. Peter, James, and John, as an example, had probably more exposure to Jesus. They had private sessions with him that the others didn't. But Judas seems to probably be on the same category as the rest of them and having access to Jesus as much as he desired. Another psalm that predicts Judas's act, Psalm 55, verses 12 through 14. And it says, "For it's not an enemy who reproaches me, then I could bear it. Nor is it one who hates me, who has exalted himself against me, then I could hide from him. But it was you, a man my equal, my companion and my acquaintance. We took sweet counsel together and walked to the house of God in the throng." You know, betrayal is a bad thing in any circumstance, in any condition that you can consider. But when it comes from within the group, it's always more devastating and just more challenging. Although I'm speaking mentally and emotionally and spiritually, to accept that within what's supposed to be a safe body, that a cancer rises up, if you will, and attacks the body. You kind of expect it to come from the outside, but when it comes from the inside, you're kind of taken aback, because this is where you trusted and where you placed your confidence that you're in a safe environment, whether that's a family or a company where you work or a church where you attend. These things are always more difficult to deal with when they come from within. Zechariah 11 also is a prophecy attributed to Judas. It's verses 12 and 13. "So they weighed out for my wages 30 pieces of silver, and the Lord said to me, 'Throw it to the potter, that princely price they set on me.' So I took the 30 pieces of silver and threw them into the house of the Lord for the potter." It's interesting that when Jesus chose Judas, he knew these prophecies. He knew these scriptures. He knew that Judas would be the one who would fulfill these prophecies of betrayal. And yet he chose him to fulfill his father's plan. And yet, as I said earlier, Judas was not coerced into doing what he did. There was no invisible hand that forced him to betray Jesus. He acted freely and without external compulsion. He was responsible for his own actions. He couldn't blame somebody else. In this particular case, God's plan and his evil deed concurred perfectly to cause the plan of God to work out. It reminds me that as Judas is responsible for his own actions, each of us are responsible for our own actions. And as a friend of mine said many years ago, and I try to keep it in mind, is that within each of us lies the seeds of our own destruction. And so it was with Judas. The seeds of his own destruction were already in him. And it's only by the grace of God and the strength of God and living in us that we can avoid those seeds planting and producing fruit. So it's good to keep in mind that Judas had those seeds of his own destruction within him. And it's not that Judas didn't have an opportunity to turn away from his sin. He had every opportunity to turn away. He heard every lesson that Jesus taught during his ministry. And many of those lessons, many of those parables, if you think about them, really apply to Judas. I'll just mention a couple or a few. Luke 16, 1 and 3 is the parable about the unjust steward. Luke 16, 1 and 3, the unjust steward How applicable is that to Jesus? To Judas. And for just sake of time, I'm going to refer to these and summarize them. Matthew 22, verses 11 through 14, is the message about the wedding garment. Who comes to the wedding? And who's rejected from the wedding? That would be applicable to Judas in many ways. In Matthew 6, verses 19 through 34, Jesus preaches against the love of money. Now, that's not a stretch to see that Jesus or that Judas would... That message would apply to Judas for the love of money. And as we'll see later, we get into his greed and so forth. Luke 13, verses 13 through 21, Jesus preached against greed. And in Matthew 23, verses 1 through 12, against pride. All of these things were things that Judas should have if he had been looking at himself and examining himself in the light of the Word, the living Word of Jesus, would have made corrections and changes in his life. But he listened to it all without applying these lessons, and he just kept up his deceit. Next, we want to talk about his disillusionment, which goes really hand in hand with his expectations, which I alluded to earlier. He was seeking to be a part of the nucleus of the Messianic kingdom that they were anticipating coming. He had expectations that certain things were going to happen along the way, that Jesus would be, instead of publicly avoiding disturbing the Romans, he would speak up against Caesar. He would speak about taxes. He would speak about the things that we talked about before that the zealots stood for and how they wanted to bring about the kingdom of God. And so it was that expectation that probably led to his disillusionment as he went on and spent these years with Jesus, expecting certain things to take place, forming political alliances, getting ready for a major battle, and preparing to set up a government and so forth. But these weren't the things that Judas or any of the disciples saw, and it confused them all, frankly, because they were looking for something different. But the others did not get so disillusioned that they betrayed their leader. All of Judea was looking for the fulfillment of the prophesied coming of the Messiah. It was a heightened era of messianic hope, and I think Judas probably traveled in hope of finding the Davidic Messiah. In John 6, verse 71, John 6, verse 71, just one verse here, it tells us that Judas was the son of Simon. And I want to point out, Simon was also a very popular name, and this is not the son of Simon the Zealot, so not the two of them are not related in that way. But some commentators believe that he and his father, as I mentioned earlier, may have been zealot sympathizers. And over time, it became apparent that Jesus was not going to overthrow the Romans. He was not going to set up a political kingdom that many of the people were expecting. By the time Jesus and the apostles went to Jerusalem for that last Passover of Jesus' ministry, Judas' commitment to betrayal was complete. At some point in those final days, his disillusionment turned to hate, and hate mixed with greed finally turned to treachery. And speaking of his greed, in John 12, verses 1 through 6, we read about the case of Mary. John 12, verses 1 through 6. And then 6 days before the Passover, Jesus came to Bethany, where Lazarus, who had been dead, whom he raised from the dead, there they made him a supper, and Martha served, but Lazarus was one of those who ate at the table with him. In verse 3, then Mary took a pound of very costly oil of spikenard, and anointed the feet of Jesus, and wiped his feet with her hair. And the house was filled with the fragrance of the oil. A pound of oil, and one of the other accounts, I think I've got it here in my notes, and I'll probably come across it in a moment. But it's right on down here in verse 5, so I'll just read on. But one of the disciples, Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, who would betray him, said, "Why was this fragrant oil not sold for 300 denarii and given to the poor?" 300 denarii was basically a laborer's yearly wage. an annual salary, 300 denarii. So you think about how much money you make in a year, and would you buy it and spend it all on one bottle or container of perfume and do that? I would say that it shows that there was some wealth in that family to be able to do that. And, of course, Jesus said that she has done it for his preparation for his burial. But notice verse 6 said, then he said, not that he cared for the poor. And this is John commenting, of course, later on, while it was happening, the disciples were no more aware of Judas' deceit and treachery than anyone else was. And they, even in Matthew's account, I believe it is, they said that the disciples went along with what Judas said and said, yeah. Why wasn't this money sold or this perfume sold and given to the poor? We could have done so much more with it. But John, in retrospect, is looking back when he writes this, and he says, this he said, that speaking of Judas, not that he cared for the poor, but because he was a thief and had the money box, and he used to take what was put in it. Now, I've got a question I don't have an answer for, but if he was skimming, if he was embezzling, where was he hiding it? I don't know. It doesn't say. But, and it doesn't say how much that he was taking, but that he was a thief. And a thief is a thief in principle, regardless of how much it is. But maybe in Bible chat some of you will have thought about that and will inform me of how much you think he might have taken. But this was a clever ploy to try and feign concern for the poor. He didn't really care anything about the money going to the poor. And it seems that this particular act may have been what we consider the last straw for Judas. Not only was he beginning to realize that he was not going to establish the kingdom that they had expected, but and that he was not going to be a part of it, but that the money that he could have been skimming off and taking for himself was being, in his mind, squandered and wasted elsewhere. In Matthew 26, verses 14 through 16, then one of the 12 called Judas Iscariot went to the chief priest. This is after he's kind of come to the end of his rope with Jesus, and goes to the chief priests and said, what are you willing to give me if I deliver him to you? It was well known that the priests and the scribes and the Pharisees were looking for an opportunity to capture Jesus and to try him and to kill him. And so Judas came and offered to do so. They counted out to him 30 pieces of silver, so that time, he sought an opportunity to betray Jesus. And now we come to his hypocrisy. When we read in John 13, just a chapter over from where we were, John 13, 1 through 5, if you're familiar with this, we read this and go through this as a part of the Passover service and the washing of feet. But now before the Feast of Passover, this is verse 1, John 13, when Jesus knew that his hour had come, that he should depart this world and to go to the Father, having loved his own who were in the world, he loved them to the end. And supper being ended, the devil already having put it into the heart of Judas Iscariot, Simon's son, to betray him, Jesus, knowing that the Father had given all things into his hands, that he had come from God and was going to God, he rose from supper and lay aside his garments. He took a towel and he girded himself. And after that, he poured water into a basin, and he began to wash the disciples' feet and to wipe them with a towel with which he was girded. And we know how Peter responded here. And, you're not going to clean me. You're going to wash my feet? I don't know. You're not going to wash my feet. And Jesus tells him, if I don't wash your feet, if I don't wash you, you'll have no part with me. The other 11 disciples all appear to be silent about it. They were, whether or not they understood, or they just weren't brash enough to oppose Jesus when he was trying to serve them, whether they got the point or not. It says that later on you will understand what I've done. And I think there's more to that than that, but we won't go into that today. But he said in verse 11, you're not all clean. And very clearly he was speaking about Judas. Let's skip ahead to verse 21 of John 13. And Jesus said these things, he was troubled in spirit. This is after he had washed their feet and told them that he was their servant, and if he was servant and greater than them and served them, that they should serve one another and be humble with one another and wash one another's feet, forgive one another's sins, and so forth. But he said in verse 21, when Jesus had said these things, he was troubled in his spirit and testified and said, most assuredly, I say to you, one of you will betray me. So there's the second time within a relatively short span when he was referring to back in verse 11 that you're not all clean, referring to Judas. Let's break into the thought here and look at Matthew 26. We're going to come back to John 13, but Matthew 26, verses 22 through 25 adds a little more to the story right at this point. Beginning in verse 22, Matthew 26, and they were exceedingly sorrowful. Each of them began to say to him, this is the disciples, Lord, is it I? Is it I? One after one they ask, is it I? Is it I? With, I think, sincere wonderment. How could that be? Could I be the one? Could the seeds of my own destruction have been planted without me knowing it, and I'm the one that's going to betray you? He answered and said, he who dips his hand with me in the dish will betray me. And the Son of Man indeed goes just as it is written of him. But woe to that man who the Son of God or the Son of Man is betrayed. It would have been good for that man if he had not been born. Verse 25. And then Judas, acting out of deceit and hypocrisy, just as it was his way, he said, Judas, who was betraying him, answered and said, Rabbi, is it I? Just like the others, hoping that there would not be an answer. But indeed, Jesus said, you have said it. And we'll go back into John 13, begin in verse 22 through 30. And the disciples looked at one another and perplexed about whom he spoke. And now there was leaning on Jesus' bosom one of the disciples, we know from other sources that was likely John, whom Jesus loved. Simon Peter therefore motioned to him to ask who it was of whom he spoke. Then leaning back on Jesus' breast, he said to him, Lord, who is it? And Jesus answered, it is he to whom I give a piece of bread when I have dipped it. And having dipped the bread, he gave it to Judas Iscariot, the son of Simon. And then now after the piece of bread, Satan entered him. And Jesus said to him, what you do, do quickly. But notice verse 28. No one at the table knew for what reason Jesus had said this to him. Buy those things which you have for the feast, maybe? Or that if he should give something to the poor? Or having received the piece of bread, he then went out immediately, and it was night. His hypocrisy was so great, and he was so good at it, that the disciples themselves didn't even wonder beyond, well, Judas is going to do something that the Lord's sending him to do. They had no idea what he was up to and what would be the result of that. He deceived them greatly and was able to work hypocrisy to no end. Luke 22, verses 47 through 48. And while he was still speaking, behold, a multitude. This is Jesus and the disciples in the Garden of Gethsemane. And he who was called Judas, one of the 12, went before them and drew near to Jesus to kiss him. But Jesus said to him, Judas, are you betraying the Son of Man with a kiss? His hypocrisy to his final interaction with Jesus was just as it always had been, phony from the beginning. And he approached him as a friend, because that was the sign that they had set up, that he would betray Jesus with a kiss. And it really wasn't necessary, because as other texts show us, when the soldiers came, Jesus asked, who are you looking for? And they said, Jesus. And he said, I am. And they fell back and were knocked away. And this happened two or three times. So he had already identified himself by stepping forward. It really wasn't necessary for Judas to do it. But he went through and completed his hypocritical act, right up to the point of giving him that kiss. Next we'll look at Judas's death. Judas had sold Jesus for a pittance, a mere 30 pieces of silver, which was the price of a slave. But as soon as the deal was done, his conscience began to come alive, perhaps for the first time in a very long time. He was beginning to regret and have remorse for what he had done. The money that had been so important to him before now meant nothing. Matthew 27, verses 3 and 4 says, "Then Judas, his betrayer, seeing that he had been condemned, was remorseful and brought back the 30 pieces of silver to the chief priests and the elders, saying, 'I have sinned by betraying innocent blood.' And they said, 'What's that to us? See you to it.'" That's your problem, bud. You've already done what you conspired to do with us. We paid you for it. But his remorse, and he was remorseful, no doubt. He regretted it. I believe that sincerely. But that's not the same. Remorse is not the same as repentance. Remorse is not the same as repentance. Matthew 27, verses 4 and 5, "And they said, 'What is that to us? You see to it.' And then he threw down the pieces of silver at the temple and departed and went and hanged himself." Judas's sin brought him unbearable misery. But once again, remorse does not seem to have engendered genuine repentance. Otherwise, I suspect and I'd suggest to you that he wouldn't have killed himself. Suicide may be an act of remorse or regret, but not of repentance. If we think about Peter, who suffered through the disgrace of denying Jesus three times on that final night, he didn't go and kill himself. He repented, and he came back to the church and to Jesus, who loved him, and took up his role that he was meant to play among the disciples and the apostles. But Judas did not. Sadly, he did not seek God's forgiveness. He didn't cry out for mercy and grace. Instead, he tried to silence his conscience by killing himself. And Matthew concludes his account of Judas in Matthew 27, verses 6 through 8. "But the chief priests took the silver pieces and said, 'It's not lawful to put them into the treasury, because they're the price of blood.' And they consulted together and bought with them the potter's field to bury strangers in. Therefore, that field has been called the field of blood to this day." And Acts 18 adds a final note to the tragedy of Judas with a little more detail about his death and the acquisition of the field of blood. In Acts 1, verses 18 and 19, Acts 1, verses 18 and 19, it says in parentheses here, "Now this man," which is Judas, "purchased a field with the wages of inequity." Now, he didn't obviously purchase it himself, but it was the money that he gave back to the chief priests, and that's how they spent it, and not wanting to probably have being soiled by blood money in any way, gave the credit for the ownership of the field to Judas. At any rate, it says he purchased a field with the wages of iniquity, and falling headlong, he burst open in the middle, and all his entrails gushed out. And it became known to all those dwelling at Jerusalem. So that field is called in their own language Akal Dama, that is, the field of blood. So apparently Judas, when you put the two stories together, apparently hanged himself on a branch or tree overhanging a group of sharp rocks down below, and either the rope broke or the branch of the tree broke, and he fell and just landed on the rocks, and it broke him open, and his intestines fell out, and it was an ugly mess, and the dogs took after him. Nasty dogs, what they will do. But they will. Wild dogs. And I think Mel Gibson in his movie showed that. And very, very graphic. At any rate, let's move along. Apparently, we're reminded of Jesus' words that it would have been good for that man had he never been born. And that's probably as well, much as we can say about him. I can't tell you whether Judas, and maybe somebody's going to ask that question. I expect it. I don't have an answer for it. I'll just tell you right now, whether Judas will come up in a future resurrection or not, whether he committed the unpardonable sin, food for chat, but I can't say. What I would like to share with you, though, are seven quick little moral lessons of his life that John MacArthur summarized, and he's the author of the book, 12 common men who do uncommon things. I forget the exact title, but nevertheless, he said that the first lesson that one should learn from Judas is he's a tragic example of lost opportunity. Lost opportunity. He spent several years, nearly every day with Jesus for several years, and heard him teach. He had access to ask him any question he wanted. He could have sought and received any help that he needed. And yet in the end, he was cursed because of his own failure to heed what he heard. All those messages that he heard that would apply to him, just thinking, not caring, not even thinking, does this apply to me or not? Just letting it roll off. Secondly, Judas is the epitome of wasted privilege. Of all the followers of Jesus, he was chosen to be one of the 12, and he cashed in on it for a fistful of coins, which in the end he decided he didn't really want. Thirdly, Judas is the classic example of how the love of money is a root of all kinds of evil, as Paul wrote to Timothy in 1 Timothy 6:10. Fourth, Judas exemplifies the ugliness and the danger of spiritual betrayal. His life is a reminder to each of us about our own need for self-examination. Had Judas had practiced an ounce of self-examination, he would surely have come to the conclusion that he needed to make changes and that he was caught up in sin. The fifth proof of the patience and forbearing goodness of the loving kindness of Christ. He kept him with him that full time, not criticizing, not putting him down, not even identifying him in the least until that last Passover meal when it became clear that the time had come. The sixth lesson that we can learn is that Judas demonstrates how the sovereign will of God cannot be thwarted by any means. His betrayal of Jesus seemed at first glance, to be a great victory for Satan, perhaps his greatest triumph ever. But in reality, it signified and signaled the utter defeat of the devil and all of his works. Judas did it for evil, but God meant it for good. If you think back to the situation of Joseph and his brothers in the Old Testament, when Joseph was sold into slavery, and years later, his brothers came to Egypt during the famine to purchase food so their family could survive. And they confessed, and they knew that Joseph was going to do them bad, get even with them for what they had done to him all those years. But he said that what you meant for evil for me, God intended for good. So God is supreme and is sovereign in all of those things. And lastly, Judas is a vivid example of the deceitfulness and the fruitlessness of hypocrisy. He's like that branch that it's not able to abide in the true vine, and it loses its sap, and that it bears no fruit. And finally, it's just cut off, and it's thrown into the fire and burned up. The tragedy of Judas' life is one of his own making. He ignored the light he had been exposed to for all those years, and so relegated himself to darkness. Let us be aware of the lessons of the life of the traitor, Judas Iscariot.